Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the Policy Committee of the St. Paul City Council to order. My name is Rebecca Naker. I'm going to be chairing today's session. I'm chairing policy sessions this year, so you can address me as Chair Naker and council members as council members. And really pleased to have Chief Henry and Shelley Klein and other guests here today to talk about an issue that's of great importance and unfortunately very timely, which is domestic violence in our community. Chief, I think we're going to start just by turning things over to you to start and introduce our guests, and looking forward to a really important conversation this morning. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Chair Naker, council members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak. Again, my name is Axel Henry. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of St. Paul Police Department. I'll let my fellow speakers or question answerers, I think it's probably going to be the better title for us, introduce themselves if they want to do that now.
Hi, I'm Shelley Johnson Klein. I'm the director of the St. Paul and Ramsey County Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, SPIP.
Good morning. My name is Tara Patet. I'm the supervising attorney of the Domestic Violence Prosecution Team at the St. Paul City Attorney's Office.
So we have a PowerPoint slide that I think you can all see up there on the board. If we could just flip to the next piece. We'll kind of walk through some of this, but I think as we found before in the past, probably the best method is that as questions come up or if we have questions, we'd rather have that be the kind of the driver behind the stuff. We could speak to a bunch of things we think you should know, but we're much more interested in finding out what it is you want to know and then answering those questions. And then I think that we can let that kind of grow organically. Just to kind of give you a context, typically in the United States, anywhere from a third, so 33% to about 50% of homicides are typically have a domestic nexus or domestic relationship involved. Typically that is, on average, more highly represented in romantic relationships with the male being the perpetrator and the female being the victim. But that, of course, is not always the case. And just like in the state of Minnesota, some domestic relationships could be with a family member like a child or a relative and an uncle. And so it's just important to understand that when you hear domestic, that's that familial relationship or people that are cohabitating together. But for the most part, kind of the assumption is usually that that's usually a romantic relationship, and for statistically, for the most part, it is. We have typically seen our numbers fluctuate anywhere between the low single digits all the way up to about a third. There have been times in our past where we've gone above that. When we began the Blueprint for Safety implementation in 2008, for an 18-month period after that, we had zero domestic homicides. The process that has now been replicated both all over the country and, to be honest with you, all over the world, does work. It's a very effective, and it's a process that really is from start to finish being looked at by every group. So it isn't just simply how the police respond to it or how advocates respond to it or how prosecutors respond to it, but it's how the bench responds to it and how the jails respond to it in every piece there. And that's really when we get the most effective system, when the entire system is communicating together. And one of the things the Blueprint does, which is very important, is it makes a common language that everyone understands. So it allows us to be able to document events as they happen and then get them interpreted in the right way by every one of the practitioners along with that. And I won't spend a bunch of time talking about that because my friend and fellow expert here is much more of an expert on that. But we just wanted to speak a little bit to that as a level set for that. So if you look at the 2022 stats, you can see we had 9 that had a domestic relationship to them. That represented 26% of our homicides. Not all of those were your kind of traditional domestic abuse, you know, domestic partner things. We had family members that were killed within that, which is one of the reasons why I brought that up. If you want to slide to the next one. I think this slide, yes. Actually, this, if you see the 2021 and 2022 years, those numbers should be flipped. So 2022 was 10, 20, or and 2020, or 2022 was 9, 2021 is 10. You'll see that that was a contradiction. That probably just didn't get caught. But you can kind of see how that has played out over the years for us. It is something that we work very hard on, and we have a very good process for. I think my partners up here will speak a little bit to how that is being looked at currently and how it can be looked to improve in the future. But I think at this point, I think it's probably okay to just jump, instead of kind of going through slide by slide, to jump to Shelley and have her discuss kind of where this plugs in from here.
And Chief, just before I move on, one question. You mentioned the percentages of domestics out of total homicides have ranged. I can't quite tell doing the quick math on this slide, but do you have a sense as to whether that percentage is trending in a certain direction since 2012?
Our homicide numbers, and I wouldn't say since 2012. I would say that, so if you look at 2016, 2 out of 21 homicides, that's 10%. So they haven't always been trending this way, but in the last 3 years, what we've seen is a trend upward. We're seeing that the percentage has moved kind of between that mid-20% up into sometimes up and at a third. And so we're seeing that. Now, there's a number of things that are probably driving, or we know are driving parts of that. That is the threshold for use of gun violence in domestic homicides, we're seeing more gunshot wound victims as people who are being killed from that. And we know that just nationally and locally, people's willingness to use firearms in any crime, including domestic violence, has just gone, that threshold has gone down. So we're seeing them being used more. We've also seen that threats with firearms. So we don't have a murder in those cases, but the domestic cases where someone was threatened with or shown a gun or hit with a gun or told they were going to get shot has gone up and up and up. And so we're seeing parts of that. And I think Shelley will also speak to some of the other factors that we're seeing that we think are driving those numbers.
Ms. Brenma, just a quick question, and Shelley, you'll probably get to this, but I know that in the Blueprint for Safety, one of the markers that you had established is that if a victim is strangled, that triggered a different sort of action from our law enforcement because we knew that the next step was likely that they would be killed. Does that translate to the gun threatening?
Yes.
Okay. Seemed like a parallel. Okay. And I'm sure you'll get into that more, but wanted to make sure I asked.
So I have a bunch of demographics on SPIP, and I'm not going to go through them, but it just shows the breadth and the volume of the work we do. We serve over 6,000 victims and their children each year. We're 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we're unique in that we reach out directly to the victim after there's been an assault. There are many different portals that we receive our referrals. The number one is from the police. When there is a domestic assault, they immediately contact our advocates. Our advocates immediately reach out. That first connection is critical. What we do is we do safety planning. Very often the victim will share things with us that they didn't feel comfortable sharing with the police. We explain what the system does and what it doesn't do because there's a lot of misinformation out there. We work with the victim. As long as they determine the timeline, we work through them throughout the criminal, the civil justice process system. We help with housing. We help with transitional services. We have support groups, the whole gamut, because domestic violence impacts every facet of a victim's life. What we have been seeing, going back to what Axel was talking about, we have been seeing the severity of abuse going up. We have seen the numbers going up and a sense of hopelessness with the victims because not only are they dealing with the abuse, but they're dealing with the economic conditions that have changed. It's very hard to pay the rent to do this, and we help with those things, but the resources are short. Housing is a huge issue also, too.
And may I jump in here on
yeah,
one
of I'm losing my voice.
Oh, okay. Good timing then. So I think that one of the things that's really impacting what we're seeing in terms of the severity and increase is the delay that's been caused by the pandemic and the backlog in the criminal courts. And so we are seeing cases delayed at an unprecedented rate. And if you imagine something, happening in your home and not having a resolution to your criminal case for over a year from that time, it really makes a profound difference. And we're seeing women victims who are subject to intimidation and manipulation at a rate that we've just not seen before. And what that does then is drive the victim decision making in not necessarily wanting to participate in the prosecution. Our prosecutions are challenged by that. that. And victims, I think, are left with this sort of sense of hopelessness that the system isn't able to respond to their safety needs in a timely manner.
I think it's a sense of hopelessness, and I think it's also very much fear. When you call 911 and the perpetrator is out the next day, and then it does, and then the case is delayed and delayed, the message is very clear that people don't care if I abuse you, and the abuse gets worse, and they do feel hopeless. But they haven't given up all hope. I mean, we're still getting a lot of 911 calls. It's just when it gets slowed down to the point where it's almost unbearable in the system, that has been a huge issue. Just to reiterate, all of our services are confidential and they're free of charge. I think that's important. We have a 24-hour crisis line. We have the first light that goes out with the police on highly lethal, and this gets back, council member, to your comment, is that every single police report is reviewed by our team of an investigator and an advocate for lethality. Firearms, pregnant, strangulation, rape, all of the above. And we send an advocate and an investigator right out to that home to meet with the victim and we're hoping to increase that, getting more of those teams out there to meet face-to-face with victims. If there's a language barrier, that's a high-risk call, all of the above. So we're out there 24/7. Over 72% of the victims we serve are from BIPOC communities. We have languages. We speak 5 different languages in our office. We represent all ages, genders, all of the above. It's very important that the people we serve see someone that understands their culture, where they're coming from, because there are a lot of barriers many victims face. 10% were homeless when they reached out for our services, acutely homeless. 90% received help with housing. Housing, again, is a huge issue. The majority, when they were attempting to leave, were at or below poverty level. Because if it was a partner's income you were dependent upon, that is now gone. 96% identify as female, 4% as male. The majority have dependent children, with 64% of those having 1 to 2 children, 32% 2 to 4 children, and over 6% have 5 or more children. There's more information on this sheet. I hope you have time to look at it. 19% of the people that we serve were new immigrants, and 16% had limited English proficiency, and 4% had a mental, physical disability. So that gives you an idea of who we're all reaching. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, the advocates that work at SPIP are amazing. They go above and beyond 24/7. We're multicultural, multilingual, multi-ages. We have a wonderful and diverse staff that really connects with victims. And if I was to just summarize what's been happening these last 2 years, agencies and SPIP is not alone. We're overwhelmed with the volume of people reaching out for our services. And I cannot think of any program that's going to say, we're at our capacity, we can't help you right now. You just can't do that. So what you end up doing is working long days and long hours, and it is hard to retain staff under those circumstances. It's very difficult work. And the people that do leave our agency do so begrudgingly. It's usually the amount of pay that they receive. But we're attempting to keep up with the volume. And again, I speak for all the programs out there that are doing direct service with victims of domestic violence. The staff shortage and the volume is really, really incredible at this time. But the women we serve, they're warriors. They come in, they want change, they want their life to be better, and it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking when their life has ended.
I Actually, Ms. Klein, just before we move on to the
to
the prosecution side. No, no. I just wanted to go back to something you said about housing being a huge obstacle, and I'm curious what resources there are now that you're able to connect your clients with. And I'm also curious, and maybe Chief, you can speak to this. Last time when we talked about our Community First Public Safety Initiative, we talked about some of the work Project Peace is doing to help connect family members of those who committed crimes with resources like housing, in some cases because they relied on the person who committed the crime for income that might help with housing. I'm just curious if there are any connections between the Office of Neighborhood Safety and helping, for example, victims of domestic violence similarly with housing supports.
Go ahead. I can follow.
Chair Naker, council members. So the answer to that is yes. As you heard Director Blakey say the last time that we were here, they're just like Shelley has explained, they're beyond their capacity, but we're building those pieces out and, you know, that kind of holistic approach to providing support in there. We obviously have the St. Paul Intervention Project as our longstanding partner that's really doing that first piece of the lift there, figuring that out. But as this continues to grow and improve, there's obviously going to be opportunities there for Brooke to support the efforts or work in tandem with the St. Paul Intervention Project to make sure that those things are happening.
We do get a lot of referrals from that project. And there are a number of resources that we'll use. Very often we'll have to put someone up in a hotel motel until we can find housing. The shelters are full, and not everybody's comfortable going to a shelter. And they're wonderful. You know, they save lives. But the fact of the matter is that we often put people up in a hotel motel, and then we work with different foundations and getting rent and getting utilities paid. We have attorneys that work to fight an eviction or just give them their rights. We've been doing landlord trainings for the city of talking about what victim rights are and how to get them the help they deserve. So it's a whole gamut that goes up. We've been very fortunate to have ARPA monies through the state that we've been able to help people pay their rent and stay in their own homes. Because it's very important if it's safe enough that a victim stay in their community where their spiritual group is, where their kids are in school. And so we really do try to do that.
Thank you. Ms. Brenmohan had a question.
Just in the statistics, did you mention what percent of the cases that you work with are related to addiction? Do you have any idea what that number might be?
We do see a fair number of cases that they're addiction issues. It is not unusual for victims to self-medicate because of the abuse. It's a coping mechanism. But I can't say that's the overriding thing that we see.
Okay. And I'm asking because the city will be getting opioid settlement money. And I want to make sure that if there's a line that we can draw to perppetrators or victims that are connected to opioid addiction or alcohol addiction, that we are able to find ways to send the money to your organization. I just will say social workers are never paid enough. They work way too long of hours and have a lot of heart in the work that you can't help but bring home with you. Even your ARPA ask from the city to me felt very modest. So I want to make sure that your team is being paid appropriately for the work that you're doing. I understand what you're saying about, like, you can't turn anybody away, but then at a certain point you're kind of giving everybody a little bit less service because you can't, you know, clone yourself.
Or you're taking your staff and they're amazing. I mean, it's like, go home. They don't go home. You know, you try to chase them out, but that can't last forever. And, yes, we used to have, which was very successful, we used to have AA groups on site for victim survivors, which was a safe place. Any of those funds would be appreciated because I think we could get them in the right place, as could other agencies that work with perpetrators.
Yeah. Well, and I'm mostly mentioning it with, you know, so that my colleagues and I are all thinking what when we have the opportunity to identify where the opioid resources go, that this is an opportunity for us as well to try to help fill that gap for you and your team.
Thank you.
Ms. Prince?
Yeah, I really appreciate Council President Brenmoen bringing that up, because we did have a presentation last fall, I believe, from the Ramsey County Public Health, because they have started to receive those funds. And I think, speaking to my colleagues, that it's time for us to get an update on that so that we understand where those funds are going, because there are funds coming in now.
Yep. Thanks, Ms. Prince. Mm-hmm. It sounded like a next step was just identified. So.
Yeah.
All right. Ms. House, yeah.
Yeah. Chair Nacre and Councilmember Prince, St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health is on the agenda on May 17th to give us an update.
Great.
And I think we should just add to that the city dollars, I think, are separate from the county dollars, and so we want to make sure we also get an update on our portion, maybe at the same time. Thanks, Ms. Prince. Any other questions before we keep going? All right.
If I could add just one more point there, Chair Nacre, council members. As been said already, and I think everyone knows this, it's not really worth spending a lot of energy on, but everyone is short in different capacities, and obviously if we could get our department up to staff, all those types of things. But one of the things that I tell folks all the time, that if they, and I think, you know, we have Brian Casey, who actually goes out and interfaces with victims and goes out and provides services. You know, we have Assistant Chief Sarir, Deputy Chief Paul Ford here from the Major Crimes Unit, as well as Commander Skolk, who's the commander of the Domestic Violence Unit. I think they would all agree that when people say to me, how can we, this domestic violence work is really murder prevention. And when people say to me, what can we do to support that in the police department? One of the first things I always tell them is give more money to SPIP so they can get more advocates, so we can send more police officers like Sergeant Casey out with an advocate to do this work and interface. And as the population grows and the sizes of our respective agencies shrink, and then we have the clog-ups that weren't caused by anybody's ill will but are delaying cases in the trial system, the fact that we're able to follow up and go out and connect with victims and survivors is crucially important. And so I just wanted to co-sign on the idea that if there is money there to be given to the St. Paul Intervention Project to hire more advocates, that will have a direct relation to us being able to do the work that we have to do. So thank you very much for saying that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chief. And I'll just add on to that, that, you know, for our role, for my role as a prosecutor, the work of St. Paul Intervention is critical to the, I'll say, success, in air quotes, of our work. And early intervention with victims is key in victims being willing to trust that the justice system is looking out for their safety, being willing to engage in the process, although, as Shelley indicates, there, sample intervention is involved with the victim and is assisting a victim throughout the process, regardless of whether a victim is participating in the prosecution. Still, with early intervention, with work with a community advocate, our work is made so much easier, and we're so much more able to hold offenders accountable. So, yeah, I would chime in. Any funding that can go towards increasing their presence is going to benefit us all. So just a little bit to kind of, I guess, start with giving you an idea of the kind of resources in the city attorney's office that we put towards domestic violence intervention. We have 8 prosecutors that I oversee, 5 victim witness staff. Victim witness staff are essentially system advocates, so they do similar work than that sample intervention does, however, just from a system standpoint. They're not confidential. However, their job is to assist victims throughout the criminal justice process, make referrals to places like St. Paul Intervention, but to a wide variety of other community resources that may be suitable for that victim's needs. We have approximately 1,000 domestic-related cases each year. Now, in 2021, our stats dropped into the high 700s. probably because, well, certainly because of the pandemic. Our victim witness team served close to 2,000 crime victims last year. That means, of course, they serve crime victims not limited to domestic violence cases. And our work is supported in part by grant funding. Our victim witness team is really propped up with grant funding. Three of our five positions are supported by a grant. So that's a conversation for another day. But next slide, please. So just a little bit about kind of where what we're grounded in terms of our domestic violence prosecution. In one of the previous slides that I think you all have the deck, there's a kind of an outline of the principles of the Blueprint for Safety. And despite the fact that the Blueprint is over 10 years old now, we really strongly adhere to the principles of the Blueprint for Safety. We know it works. We know that it's effective. We know that if as close as we can stay grounded in those key principles, we will do better by victims. I think the most important they're all important, but I'd say the most important is really attention to risk and severity. And that's where I think a lot of today's conversation and a lot of our collaboratives really is centered on. And that is looking at risk. In each individual case that comes into our office, we are assessing risk, and we're looking at sort of research-based risk factors that point to the risk of lethality. So things like, and you mentioned strangulation, access to firearms, sexual aggression, abuse in the presence of children, stalking, threats to kill, those kinds of things. When those factors are present, whether it's in the case at hand or previously, when those factors are present, we know that the risk of lethality is going up and that that's something that we need to take into consideration in our prosecution. And how do we take that into consideration? We mention those things and we make that risk visible during our bail arguments, during our plea negotiations, during our sentences. We're wanting to make sure that the judges, probation officers, the PSI writers, that everybody who's working on that case has an understanding of context, has an understanding of this wasn't just, now keep in mind with misdemeanor prosecution, a lot of these cases don't involve severe injury. It may be a slap, but it may be a slap that followed a attempted strangulation 3 days earlier. There's a lot of research that talks about people who commit domestic homicide don't follow this neat little pattern of first they commit a misdemeanor, then a gross misdemeanor, and then a felony, and then homicide. That's not how it often works. People often go from misdemeanor or no criminal history whatsoever to a homicide. And so paying attention to risk and severity is one of the most important things that we can do as prosecutors.
And just in that pause moment, just to clarify, because you said something was helpful for me. My understanding is that the city attorney's office only prosecutes up to the misdemeanor level. So you're talking about those 1,000 cases are misdemeanor level domestic violence offenses, and then anything more severe would be prosecuted by the county attorney's office?
That's correct. Misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor.
And gross misdemeanor. Okay.
Right. So a misdemeanor punishable by up to 90 days, or 90 days, gross misdemeanor 1 year, and then a felony is punishable over that. So if someone has three domestics in a 10-year period, each domestic is enhanceable. Each domestic assault conviction or other types of domestic-related offenses like protective order violations, those types of things, each of those are they're called qualified domestic violence, QDVR, qualified domestic violence-related offense. So if you commit one and then you commit another within a 10-year period, that's a gross misdemeanor. If you commit another within that same 10-year period, now you're in the felony world. So I think collaboration really, and that's what I think the key to a lot of this work that we want to talk with you about today is about is our collaboration. And I think that's one of the things that makes St. Paul unique and successful, although, you know, here we are talking about today in the wake of what's been a real tragic couple of years. But our collaboration really is the heart of the work that we do. We could not do our work successfully without the partnership that we have with St. Paul Intervention, without the kind of relationship that we have with St. Paul Police Department, the daily conversations that I have with the commander of the Family Violence Unit and the investigators. That is really key to our work. Can you go back to the previous slide? Okay, thank you. Another thing that I want to highlight the city attorney's office is really focused on is removing barriers to justice experienced by traditionally marginalized communities. We really are focused on making our work, making the justice system accessible to all in our community. We have informational brochures for victims that are printed in 5 different languages. We use the language line and interpretive services. We really are dialed into making sure people from the immigrant community understand the U visa process, how to access that. We are making sure that people with age-related access issues are addressed. We have training for staff on the unique barriers to safety that older victims may experience, older victims of domestic violence. And we work closely with Ramsey County Adult Protective Services on a multidisciplinary team. So we want to make sure that we're addressing domestic violence across the lifespan and recognizing how those dynamics change over a person's life cycle. Thank you. Next slide, please. So we'll talk a little. I know Shelley's has a few slides on kind of each one of these, but these are some of the domestic violence initiatives and collaboratives that the city attorney's office is involved in. And I want to highlight just one of those, and I have a few slides on our Gone on Arrival project that I'll really just go through kind of quickly, and then you can certainly ask questions as they come up. And the Domestic Violence Early Resolution Program for first-time lower-risk offenders is a pilot project that we've been running for first-time DV offenders who come in as low-risk. And that's low-risk in terms of the risk factors that I outlined earlier. It also is low-risk in terms of criminogenic need, which is a risk assessment that Justice Point does when someone is booked on a new offense. And so we wanted to have, you know, the blueprint has a lot of guidance on what we do in high-risk domestic violence cases, but what are we doing for lower risk? What are we doing to remove some of the collateral consequences that perpetrators may experience for a domestic violence offense? We often hear from victims that what they want is for the violence to stop. They don't necessarily want someone to go to jail. They want the violence to stop. They want programming for their offender. Often, and you know, I've been a prosecutor for 30 years, and in my early years, I learned very quickly that if in a conversation with a victim, if I was able to outline for them early on that I wasn't seeking a lot of jail time or any jail time for some of these first-time offenders, there would be this release and much more likelihood of being willing to engage in the criminal justice system because they're afraid that this person was going to go to jail, that it was going to be their responsibility. Now they wouldn't be around to be able to work, to care for the children. So the early resolution program is a way to catch some of these younger offenders. Heavy programming and domestic violence programming with a hope of catching some of these young offenders early. It's still a pilot. Our numbers are rather low. We really scrutinize who goes into the program, but so far we've been very successful. We've only had one offender who has violated his probation while in this program. So far so good on that. We're going to talk about I think the rest of these in the rest of our program. But next slide. I'll just give you a little bit of information about the Gone on Arrival project, because it's a project that we're very proud of, that has been replicated in other jurisdictions across the country, and is something whenever we go and talk about the blueprint with other communities, often a thing that really catches people's attention is this Gone on Arrival project. What are Gone on Arrival cases? So Gone on Arrival cases, that's a police term for a suspect who flees the scene prior to police arrival. The acronym is GOA. And we know that about half of domestic violence offenders flee the scene prior to police arriving. We know that people who flee the scene, of course, often they do so because they know that they're savvy and they know that it's less likely they're going to be held accountable for what they've done. They know that often law enforcement isn't going to be able to locate them, and the period of time that passes means that there's much less likelihood that they'll ultimately get arrested. But we also know that these offenders are more dangerous. Statistically, they're more dangerous, and they're certainly more dangerous because they're an ongoing threat because they're still at large. Next. So typically, a criminal justice justice system's response to GOA cases is that the report gets written, report then gets submitted to an investigator. An investigator takes whatever time that they need to do an investigation, hands it over to the prosecutor, and it sits on the prosecutor's desk with lower priority than the cases that are in custody out of necessity, right? Because when someone is arrested, there are certain timelines that we have to adhere to, 36 hours, 48 hours. We have to meet those deadlines. With gone on arrival cases, we don't have those kinds of deadlines. And so In our office in the past and in other offices across the country, those cases just, they get lower priority. The problem with that, of course, is that it sends really bad messages to the victim. The message to the victim is that the system doesn't care about your safety. Victims aren't hearing from anyone. Like, gosh, what happened? What happened with the case? I made this report, and I didn't hear anything more about it for 3 months. It may take 3 or 4 months before a case will get charged. The message to patrol officers was, well, I wrote this report and I never heard anything more about it. It must not be worth the time at the scene putting into these cases if the suspect's already gone on arrival. And then, of course, the message to the perpetrator was, it pays to flee. Our charging rates and conviction rates on gone on arrivals were significantly lower than in custody cases. So we really took a look at what can we do to change that. And what we did was we decided to take a next day review to collaborate with the St. Paul Police Department. An investigator and a prosecutor works together the very next day, takes a look at every single gone on arrival case that came in the night before. It could be 2, it could be 20. They look at each individual case. They look at risk and severity. They look at prior police reports. They make a decision together on whether that case is chargeable and what would be needed to make it chargeable if it's not. Victims are notified by a system advocate, so a victim witness staff from my office, right away what's happening. Referrals are made to St. Paul Intervention. Of course, St. Paul Intervention probably already has that report. But we're making referrals to community resources and really working together to get that case charged quickly. In the first year of that program, we quadrupled our charge and conviction rate on gone on arrival cases. So it really has been an important improvement in how we've handled our gone on arrival cases. Next slide. I think I pretty much covered that. Just to give you an idea of the kind of numbers we're talking about, last year we reviewed 1,100 gone on arrival cases. So it's a lot of cases. And we cast a pretty wide net. So even if something looks like it's, oh gosh, it's just really not a case that's going to be chargeable, we might look at that case and see that, for example, the perpetrator, while it's not a case that probably is something we can charge, we'll see that the perpetrator was intoxicated at the time, and we can look and see that they're on probation. probation for a DWI, we can contact their probation officer and see if we can kind of have a consequence that way with a probation violation. Things like that that we can do that is an intervention short of a domestic violence charge. I think next slide.
I just want to say how remarkable it is that this project, by essentially focusing attention on an issue, had such dramatic results. I mean, just taking the time to say this is not something that we're going to let sink to the bottom of a pile on a desk, but we're going to review it the next day and put that focus on it, it's really incredible. So kudos to you and your team.
Thank you.
Saves lives. Were there any questions?
Any other questions? Mr. Lally.
Thank you. First, just a comment. When at the end of last year, there's usually like some kind of annual news report that says, here's how many homicides there were in St. Paul, and it does a breakdown. And I asked my staff, can you analyze how many of these are related to domestic violence? Like, I feel like we keep hearing about homicides, but there isn't like media reporting of the breakout of how much of this is specifically like men killing women, all these things creating these like terrible breakdowns. And so our rough math was like 11 out of 41 were domestic violence related, and I recognize that's like imperfect. We tried to piece it together, but that's like a third of the homicides. And so to just put some numbers from last year into the point that was made, I think it was you, Chief, that said what we're doing is literally murder prevention. It's very sobering for me, and listening to this is very heavy. I'm very interested in kind of unpacking a little more. Fundamentally, a lot of this work will require transforming like abusers, like actually doing deep work with people who are harming others and changing them over time with them to like take accountability and manage themselves differently. And I recognize people are all in like different stages of how violent they've chosen to be and whether they can turn back. But I'm very interested in just more conversation, or I guess could you share more about what does it look like to do the work with people who are creating harm, to do reflection and to actually like take accountability, and really the deeper relational work that is important, and won't, you know, we won't like see these numbers go down if some big proportion of people committing these acts are like given the space to transform, which can be hard. It can be hard socially and politically because of how much harm they have incurred. But actually, the other alternative is that we throw them away and or put them away. And sometimes that's necessary so they don't keep hurting people. But I think that's like the complexity that we have to grapple with. So I guess my question to summarize is, can you share more about what it looks like to do the work with the people who are actually abusing other people and how we're trying to change that with them?
If you don't, Atera, the lower level offender, lack of a better term, program is amazing, and we're hoping to get that as a part of the blueprint itself. It's an organic document. One of the things our agency has done because of our flare-up project, which really focuses on highly lethal cases, advocate, investigator goes out to the scene. We work very closely with all our other partners. We were approached by the United Way to say, will you start a group for highly lethal offenders? Which I hesitated because we're victim service providers, but they were very compelling. So what we did is we spent months developing a curriculum for highly lethal offenders, and the group that we measured success in each part of it was a group of 18 victims of highly lethal offenders, a very diverse group. So this curriculum, which is 26 weeks, 2 hours, it talks about anger management. Domestic violence isn't anger management. They're very selective in who the victim is and when they, but if you're in the relationship and you feel like you're gonna go off, get out, walk out, all those different skills, the impact on children, everything else. We had AXA would look it up for it, just not in St. Paul, but nationally, we had
a 15% violent recidivism rate. And for this group of people, that's very low, very low. It's very successful. One of the things that they wanted us to do is to have what they call tune-up groups, that they could come back and talk and everything. What happened was United Way stopped funding all domestic violence programs. That money was lost. I had to recoup victim services. But fortunately, because of some ARPA monies through the state, I did get a grant to get that group going again and to connect it to our highly lethal work. And it's free. We're not going to charge $20. We're not going to do anything, but we want people to attend. And that group, we haven't crunched the numbers yet, but that is one thing that we're doing, because we have all had people that we love and we care about do horrible things, and you want them to change. And that is one thing that we've done that has been successful. Anybody else?
Yeah, Jerry Naker and council members. If you think about the blueprint as an entire system, so I kind of, the analogy I would use is you have a plumbing pipe, and the 911 system is not clogged, so it gets a lot of calls, but the calls are coming in. The police response, although we're short officers, we're not going to not respond, so we go. And even if it's a GOA case, we write a report, we're going to investigate that. SPIP, as you've heard, as short as they are and as much as they could use more help, is their employees are just going to stay later in the day. They're not going to fail to serve. So what invariably happens, the prosecution is willing to take these cases. But typically, to Councilmember Jalali's point, is when we're doing some of the restorative pieces to help offenders not reoffend or become folks that would never want to do that behavior again, that's happening through the court process as a part of the decision being made, that you can go down a path to say, I'm recognizing what I did, I want to seek help, I don't think punishing you out of your problem is the solution. But if those cases are getting clogged up in that pipeline where they're getting backed up and things are getting dismissed, to the points that have already been made, that person is never actually getting to that part of the process. And unfortunately, the system is teaching them that you don't really have a problem because they dismissed your case, or they pushed it off so long that now there isn't a sense of well, I know why I'm going to this class because of this thing I did 18 months ago that just isn't there. So, I mean, those processes are baked into our criminal justice system, and they do work. And as you've heard, there are new ones being explored all the time. But when the system gets clogged up, sometimes that can create an issue for those types of things even to be accessible, let alone effective.
We also do a lot. We work with victims wherever they're at in the relationship. So if they're staying, if they're in, if they're leaving, they're the experts on their own life. So we take those things into consideration, that there is still a family there that they want to keep together, and we work within that with them.
Ms. Bremont?
I realize we're talking about humans, and this is, and I keep getting back to money, and it's mostly just because I recognize the importance of the work, so I want to acknowledge that. I don't want to seem tone deaf, but when you talk about the mental health work you're doing and anger management work you're doing, the first thing I thought was, why can't we bill insurance companies for that? And as a way to make it, grant funding is great when you have it, but when it goes away, you know, your program disappears. And obviously some people have insurance and some people mm-hmm. don't, but in cases where they do, I'd be really interested in figuring out a way to be able to bill out for that invaluable service you're providing to people. That is murder prevention, but it is also like it's holistic life embetterment and
an opportunity.
Right. So I'm committed to looking into that as an opportunity, because it would be a reliable funding source if you knew that at least people who were insured in your program could get billed out for that. Maybe we cover the deductible or the copay piece or whatever, but those, you know, more and more often we're seeing smaller, like physical therapy or other smaller therapy standalones that are providing that service to people. And I think we'd have to figure out a way to make your funding reliable. And not something where you're chasing grants, because when they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah, and it can happen overnight. But thank you, council members, for bringing those up, because that's very important, and it's something I think all of us have seen someone you grew up with, someone that you owe your life to, is suddenly arrested for domestic, and it's heartbreaking. And you get or the historical trauma they've gone through and everything else. So we have to do both, and having the capacity. And going back to another remark, we have to do prevention. We don't. Intervention is prevention. We prevent homicides. But prevention, culturally appropriate, getting working with the communities and having a community response, those things are critical too. And
thanks, Mr. Ballinger?
I'm just curious why people that run from the scene get less time.
They don't. If they, let's see. Yeah, the charge is the same. If they flee the scene, what can happen is that it's less likely that they ultimately get convicted because of the delay that fleeing the scene causes. What we've done is try to sort of arrest that. Pun intended, I guess, and make sure that people are more likely to be held accountable when they do flee the scene. But ultimately, when they're charged with a domestic violence-related offense after they flee the scene, they would get the same consequence as someone who was arrested.
Could I just add a piece to that, Chair Naker, council members? So 30 years ago, or when I started 27 years ago, although the statute was very clear that if you went to report a domestic, you needed to write a report, I think what a lot of police departments around the country thought is you arrive on the scene, you're met at the door by the woman, she says, hey, he's gone. And okay, well, good, problem kind of solved, or at least partially solved at this point. The person who was threatening you or chasing you around the house or whatever left. And what the data really plays out, and this is just beyond question at this point, we know this, that the worst bullies out there, the worst offenders out there, they run when they learn the cops are coming. And it's just that simple. So what the blueprint has done and what we have adopted our position here is that when we get there and they're gone, that's a red flag for us. And we know that the worst of the worst, that's what they do. So we treat those cases that way and make sure that they're looked at that way. And so whatever charge ends up being appropriate or approved isn't ever any less. It's also not more, but it's a flag for us on where should that case be prioritized? Because as been stated, we have a timeline when someone is in custody that we have to deal with that case in a short amount of time. But what the blueprint recognizes and what we in fact train people all over this country is the GOA cases, if your thought is, oh, problem solved, absolutely the wrong answer, and actually should probably be equal to someone that's in custody because those are typically our most dangerous folks. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Chief. I think we can keep going.
All right. The next slide is about our collaborative work. And both partners here have talked about we could not do this without collaboration. And that could not be more than true. I'll tell victims when they say, thank you, SPIP, you saved my life. And I'll often say, we're honored to do that, but you don't see all the other people who are part of valuing you and wanting you safe. And that's what collaboration is. Nobody can do this alone. I know we've talked about the Blueprint for Safety, and one of the things about the Blueprint for Safety, I think we're a slide back, is, yes, it really focuses on each part of the system having protocols and policies, each arm of the system that governs how they keep victims safe, hold perpetrators accountable, but it also includes how do you work together and not treat that victim like a piece of paper, that this is the real life. But there are other things that happen with it, too. We monitor. We do ongoing monitoring to make sure that these policies and practices are being followed in each arm of the system. We have victim focus groups that keep informing the Blueprint for Safety of what's working, what isn't, are there unintended consequences, and what do we need to change. There's cross-discipline coordination that actually saves lives. And we also look for the disparity of impact We look for implicit, explicit biases based on race. based on gender that could be coming out in the system, because we want the blueprint to be to keep victims safe, but we want it to be fair and equitable to all parties involved. So that's very important to the blueprint work. Do you have anything to add about the blueprint?
No, I think you're...
The next slide, just to talk about some of the collaborative work, and I've listed all the people involved in these collaborations, is that there are laws. We have laws to remove firearms, prevent perpetrators from having firearms, but there was never any processes in place to do that. So our Blueprint Steering Committee, which people right here are part of, worked hard to dig deep and create protocols and practices to transfer those firearms for dangerous perpetrators that have orders for protection. It's one of, having a firearm is one of the highest lethality. And the protocol was developed, and it's in place in civil court. I just had a good example the other day. A victim we're working with said that his two automatic guns were taken from him, or he had to give them up because of this protocol. So, and it impacts other gun-related crimes as well. So this is, again, it was a collaborative adventure. Everybody was at the table. We didn't think we could do it, but we just kept pushing on. Right now the group is trying to get a protocol and policy and model in place in criminal court. So that's happening right now currently.
And the civil side is for protective orders. So when you are the subject of a protective order, you're prohibited from possessing a firearm during that time. So that's the civil side. And the criminal side is there are criminal laws that prohibit possession upon conviction. In the state, you are prohibited for misdemeanor domestic assault for 3 years. Felony, it would be for your lifetime. And under federal law, of course, it's a lifetime ban for now. We'll see what happens with that law.
This is critical, though. Next slide. We talked about the flare-up project. Some of the folks are here that are doing it. We identify probably 1,000 police reports each year that are considered highly lethal and make contact with the victims face-to-face or at the very least attempt to make that contact, and we always follow up. This program saves lives. There's so much misinformation out there about what the police do and don't do, and victims are very afraid to reach out. And it's great to go out there. We're separate but together. The advocate meets separately. The investigator meets separately. And it's up to the victim. And when you're at that door, more times than not, you're welcomed into their home to talk. The Domestic Violence Homicide Prevention Team, it focuses on reducing domestic homicides. We started this team 2 months ago because of the high rate of homicides. And what our group does is that we share amongst ourselves, and again, you can see all the partners there, perpetrators that we need a collective input on that are highly lethal that we think it's going to be a homicide. So everybody's at the table, everybody's focused, focusing increased sanctions on the perpetrator as well as increased advocacy services for these victims at high risk. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think we've learned already that when I bring a name to this group, having everybody, every arm of the criminal justice system and our community advocacy partners able to say, here's what I could do with this particular, here's what I know about this guy, here's what I can do, here's some information I can provide. I think knowledge is power, certainly when it comes to trying to successfully intervene with these, I'll say guys, it's sometimes women, but very, 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 very seldom is it women. I think already we're seeing the impact that this work can have.
And the Blueprint for Safety Steering Committee, and again, these are all our partners, and in this particular case, it did include the bench. We have a domestic homicide review committee where we sit down, each arm of the system, with our advocates, and we take a domestic homicide case, and everybody brings everything to the table. And it's an amazing thing to see because it's a confidential group, and we've had people, the officer involved, the county attorney involved, bring it and say, this is what we did, and we create a whole timeline of the victim's interaction with the system as well as the perpetrator, and where were their gaps? Where were things that we can change and do better? And so after we go through that process, then we come up with things that need to be changed that go to the department heads. We're going to be doing that consistently now to look at every single one of these homicides. And we find things out that it isn't to blame anybody. It's what are your resources, how are we connecting, and how, where are there the weak spots, where are there the gaps. So it's amazing how honest people are, because this collaborative, this group, each and every one of them feels passionately about this issue.
Ms. Klein, just before you move on, can you talk a little bit in more detail about what the homicide prevention team can do when you have someone who you believe is highly lethal or potentially about to murder someone but hasn't obviously done that yet? What are the specific things that you can do to prevent that from happening?
I talk about it from the system.
It's really case specific. I think it's sharing information so that we can to assist in a successful prosecution. It can be sharing information with probation to bolster their ability to maybe file a probation violation on a person. It can be, I think often it's a lot of strategies to engage the victim and help learn what barriers might be getting in the way of her being involved in the system, being willing to participate in the system, which, you know, a lot of this falls on SPIP, and referring to knowing about different agencies that may be able to assist a victim to make them more able to participate in the criminal justice system. I'm trying to think of what else.
I think having all the partners at the table and looking at this, make sure that these cases don't fall through the cracks, that everybody has eyes on these cases. It isn't unusual for our first light team, the advocate and the investigator will get a call from the city attorney, they'll get a call from the county attorney. We need more information. Can you go out there? Can you do this? It's everybody really working very tightly, intensely together around these cases because they are so highly lethal.
Mm-hmm. It's also sharing information about the history of violence and the relationship that we may not individually have, but other arms may have. So the city attorney's office may have information about a perpetrator that the county attorney's office doesn't have that they can use to assist in their prosecution. We may be able to work together to take what a case that's currently charged as a misdemeanor and highlight the lethality factors that are present and work with the county attorney to build a stalking case, for example. So take a few cases that are pending that are lower level and make them into a higher level offense. Those are the kinds of strategies we talk about in the group.
Thanks.
I think from the
Ms. Prince has a question, but please continue. We don't want to interrupt.
I think from the police perspective too that these are high on their radar. They have this list. It's high on their. I hate to call it a list because we just share names and it's a monthly meeting, but we're in contact with each other. I can think of a case where the investigator called me from the St. Paul police. We both talked. We said this one is at the county. He's going to kill her. Called the county attorney. I just called and said, this person is going to end up dead. And we can have a case that maybe it comes in as a misdemeanor, but we're confidential. We don't share details. But SPIP can slide a name across the table, and that's going to be looked at seriously because we know everything going on that isn't in the system yet. So it has been, as a part of the flare-up, very productive in reducing domestic homicides. In fact, when we had these components together and we're working them, it was 65% reduction in domestic homicides first year.
And I think working together in this way, you know, there's this collaboration, but it's also trust building. We trust each other. We trust that if Shelley slides a name our way, I can trust that that's on good information because we have this established relationship. And I know that the information that she's going to give is information I can rely on.
Thank you so much. Ms. Prince.
Yeah. There have been a few high-profile domestic homicides in my ward recently, and it seems that from information that I've gathered informally, that at least one of these fell through the cracks, and I'm wondering if the bench is participating in these meetings that you talk about to review these after the fact and be able to take a hard look at what we won't do again. I just wondered if you could speak to the participation of the bench.
Prince, yes. In fact, I just reached out to Sarah Gruen, who is a very good judge and very committed. I mean, many are. To sit on this committee. But yes, we have always had the bench involved because whatever we find is going to be, you know, if there's a gap, it's going to be shared, and that's critical. So yes, that's one of the things that we really hope to come out of this committee is where are there gaps, and those that are accountable or have power to reduce those grants are going to be notified about them, and our committee is going to know about them.
Thank you.
If I could add one thing to that, Chair Naker, council members, that's an area where, as we look back on 2008, this was front page news. This was the new shiny thing. It was the new thing people were all believing in, and everyone really made that a priority in their training. And as things go, it can often be that priorities change, challenges are different. Mindset, you know, leadership evolves or shifts or
and
whatever.
This is the blueprint training.
Correct. And the elements
that you're referring
as a part of it. So we are constantly refreshing and rebolstering. For example, the firearms issues that were related to recovering firearms was something that year one and two wasn't really a big thing for us, but as we started to identify. And so I would just humbly ask that whenever possible, if you're seeing folks, whether it's the bench, whether it's you know, the city attorney's office, the county attorney's office, any of those kind of things that are taking active steps to be parts of the refreshing and the refocusing and reprioritizing, that is cheered on from our city council because that really goes a long way. Again, I'm not suggesting any of our partners are resistant to that, but I also recognize that they've got priorities that just sometimes this doesn't put this as one, two, or three. And anytime we can say, hey, let's all refresh and know that when we do make this a top priority for us, it really does work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the last slide is our PDAS group. It's a Partnership for Domestic Abuse Services. And this goes beyond SPIP and our system players. This involves community-based programs. I've listed them all, the sister shelter, culturally specific programs, as well as my partners here. And we meet to talk about what can we do to take it to the next level as a group, as a community. One of the things that I think you're all familiar with is Bridges to Safety, which we have managed to open 3 days a week so far. In which we have one safe location where all our multiple partners go down there to provide services. You take off whatever hat you have in there. It is a safe haven for victims and give them services. And then we each follow up with them and provide ongoing services. Another thing that and the St. Paul Police and the city attorney, as well as every partner mentioned here, sat at the table for months And we wanted to look at, we all recognize that people with severe mental health issues, we all tried to do our best, but there was more we could do and we just didn't know how to do it. So we sat down, we had a consultant, we explored all these mental health models nationally, and we created a model for our partnership, for our team, that's going to have a coordinator create a network of mental health providers in which we're going to look at your sensitivity to all different communities, your languages, how do you get paid, are you accessible, get them trained on domestic violence, so when any of our partners have a, whether it be Asia Women United and they have a victim in their shelter that has a mental health issue, they can call that coordinator and they will give them two or three good referrals that they can connect that victim to and do with. Because when an agency calls, you get an answer. When a victim calls, they don't get a call back. Mm-hmm. So it's to really bridge that. And we're also going to have cultural consideration tools. There are different cultures that I myself may talk to your dead ancestors and everything. It doesn't mean you're crazy. To really look at the people from within their context. And obviously two pages can't do that, but a lot of good referrals. And a toolkit. You're not going to diagnose people, but get an idea of what you might be working with to, and what techniques could help to calm things down. So this is something that we just hired a coordinator on, and we're all relieved that it's going into place, because this is just, as I said, 4% of the victims we work with had severe mental health issues. Most victims have mental health issues due to the abuse. So it's a very, very important component of our collaborative work. And I'd just like to add that, you know, some very nice things have been said about SPIP, but I honestly have to say, particularly the two entities at this table, none of this would have been possible without their input and without the support of the City Council and the Mayor's Office. It's the blueprint for safety was spearheaded by the City of St. Paul. These initiatives are your initiatives, and we appreciate that because it saves lives.
Thank you so much. I'm looking to my colleagues to see what comments, questions, reflections people have after this extremely informative presentation. Mr. Tolbert.
Yeah, well, I just want to thank you all for the work and the continued innovation. When there's gaps or there's, you know, things that are getting missed, to try and address those things in an innovative way and try new things. The question I guess I have is, obviously we're not the ones out in the field. You guys are the experts out there. And outside of giving more money to SPIP, which I think most people at this table know I'd be supportive of, what else could we do from our position to make it successful and to save people's lives more? Is there anything else from the council or the mayor's perspective that we could do to be helpful?
Chief.
Chair Nager, council members, thank you for that. Again, I would just reiterate what I said earlier, which is as much as we can show up as a city to champion that folks, whether it's the attorney from the 911 calls all the way through to sentencing and probation, make this a priority, make sure, I mean, I would love to see other, I mean, I don't get to control what the other entities do, but I would love if I found out that every entity said, every year we at least refresh ourselves on this, we bring in folks to talk about this, we do a data review on it to see how it's working so that I know that it's built mechanically into their system as a part of that, that they're always looking to refresh this. You can be our great cheerleaders for that. You can go out and say things as a collective body and as individuals to champion that, and if that's something you believe in and willing to do, I know I would greatly appreciate it.
I echo that as well. I mentioned earlier our system advocates in our office, or our victim witness team, is really propped up by grant funding that will end at the end of 2023, and we will be needing to seek funding to make some of those positions city-funded positions. We simply could not do the work that we do in my office without system advocates. Community advocates, are, of course, a very, very important partnership for us. But having somebody in the office who is helping guide a victim throughout the criminal justice process is critical. And we are right at having five people handle 1,800 cases in a year is no small feat. So I'll make that plug now for what ultimately will come, I think, as a request to you.
I would like to add that, Councilmember Nachran, finally getting it right in council members. I would like to add, some years ago we surveyed a lot of victims, a lot of women. We went to Brian Coyle, we went all over, we did it 7 different languages, and we asked, what do you wish you would have known then that you know now to reach out for services? And the number one thing that they said is that I'd be treated kindly. Mm. I'll be believed. I'll be helped. There's so many victims out there, and I think 4 of these cases that the St. Paul police have put together here, 4 of the cases from last year, I don't think there was any involvement in the system. We need to get the word out. We need to get the word out in every way we can that if you're a victim, you are valued. There are programs here that want to assist you. You will be treated kindly and you will be believed. Please, please call.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much. And I'm thinking as you're talking about ways in which, to Mr. Tolbert's really excellent question, that we can help raise that kind of awareness and invite SPIP and others to the community events that we have and just use the reach that we have to get that message out. I think I saw Ms. Jalali and then maybe Mr. Ballinger. Oh, no. Ms. Jalali?
No, I think.
Oh, didn't see anybody. Okay. Imagining things. Anyone else have any? Ms. Prince?
Yeah, I Council Member Tolbert said this for all of us, but what an incredible team. What an incredible presentation to our St. Paul police professionals who are in the room. The fact that so much of what we talked about today was the ongoing response to the changing circumstances, and that you're, just like our police department, you're constantly innovating to be able to solve the problem in different ways. So we all just thank you, and we're very grateful and proud of what you do.
Thank you. Thank you for having us here. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah, to echo Ms. Prince's beautiful words, thank you again. And I'm really struck leaving this presentation by just how you're able to balance both the individual response and treating people as the unique human beings they are and that constant case management and checking in daily, constantly, with the systems approach that you take and helping people navigate those systems and then trying to change those systems. And to Ms. Prince's point, always looking for what you can do next to meet the new need. It's very powerful. So thank you for the work you do. Thank you for being here today. And if there's nothing else to come before us, we're adjourned.